Hi, and welcome back to my favourite Elliot Smith song. If you haven't heard us before, this podcast is pretty simple, really. We tried to do our bit to keep Elliot Smith's legacy alive by speaking to well-known fans about their favourite song of his. So hi, and I hope you've been keeping well these past few months. This is our first episode since the end of last year, and it feels like a lot has changed, but also, at the same time, not very much has changed at all, really. And one thing that is very much still the same is that we're going to do our best to bring you some interesting Elliot Smith-related stories and interviews over the next 5 or 6 months or so. And today we're starting with a good one, I think. Our guest is the musician Mike Doty. Mike founded the band Soul Coughing in the early 90s, which was a fairly experimental mix of Mike's poetry, hip-hop, jazz, and quite a lot of other things besides that as well. After that band broke up, Mike has gone on to do several other solo projects and collaborations as well. Now living in Memphis, Tennessee, Mike caught up with Elizabeth Woodstanley recently, where he discussed his love of Elliot Smith, his favourite song pick, what it was like meeting Elliot for the first time, and what happened when he sampled some of his music. So I'll play you that interview now. This is Mike Doty talking to Elizabeth Woodstanley.
My name is Mike Doty. I am a singer and a songwriter, and I was the founder of the band Soul Coughing in the 90s, which is when I met Elliot. My favorite Elliot song is Christian Brothers. How to sort of describe the very particular magic that this song has, I think it begins with the sound of the tape hiss at the beginning of the song, which happens just like a fragment of a second before the first sound of the guitar. And it's this huge tape hiss sound that I think would be entirely unacceptable to any recording engineer, but it is there and it's big and it is plain as day, such that, so he's playing snare drum throughout the song, just doing like little hits on the two and the four, just very simple stuff. And there's a certain technique for using brushes on a snare drum that jazz players use. I don't know what it's called, but they sort of swirl the brush on the head of the snare in kind of like a pattern, and it's creates this kind of swishing sound that could sort of like live in the hi-hat space. As the song keeps going, I keep thinking like he's doing that. He's like doing that brush thing, but it's the static. The song has this really peculiar rising quality where like it's almost as if the guitar seems to be like a child singing out of its range, out of their range. It, you know, just gets higher and 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 higher, and seems to like never resolve. It is like this endless, unresolving chord change. And it's like that. It's like the noisiness, the cyclical nature of the song. I mean, there's so much that's incredibly special about the song and this particular recording. No bad dream fucker's gonna boss me around. Christian Brothers gonna take him down.
You know, what about lyrically? Are you drawn to this song as far as, you know, what it is he seems to be talking about?
The opening line, "No bad dream fucker's gonna boss me around." And there's just something so comic about it when you look at it on paper, and it's so urgent and so strange. I mean, just one of the all-time great opening lines for a song. And, you know, I actually did something terrible, which was look up the song on Reddit like an hour before now and listen to these different, you know, or read these different interpretations of what the lyrics meant. None of them I had actually thought of, and none of them I had even thought to think of. Just, you know, I've seen the boss blink on and off, and the world of the song and the persona of the character singing it, I just always sort of took for what it was as an artistic presence, as opposed to trying to, like, you know, dig a meaning out of it.
What were you getting from the song before kind of exploring these other, you know, interpretations?
So this character that is just so insistent and so aggrieved. And, you know, like, it's really hard to say fuck in a song, much less motherfucking, and make it sound not like, you know, like, you know, you're a kid who learned the word for the first time, you know. I mean, generally, you know, the use of the word fuck in rock songs is like, you know, there's a little bit too much emphasis on it, or it seems a little artificial in there. I mean, he just uses the word beautifully, just phrases it beautifully. It's compelling in a way that I guess profanities are supposed to be compelling. They can't help me get on.
Did you, you know, I've read people's interpretations of the song too. I actually had never crossed my mind that Christian Brothers was a form of brandy. I'd never come to the song thinking, oh, this is also a name of a brandy.
Wow. Well, it's also the name of a college, which I'm actually like a mile from right now. I had no idea. I moved down to Memphis from New York like 5 years ago. And there is a Christian Brothers University right here in Memphis, which I had no idea was a thing.
So was the, since obviously the name of the brandy was familiar to you, did that relate to the song? Like, were you feeling like that was... you know, something he was drawing from?
I had thought of the sort of ghost of the alcohol, or the presence of the alcohol, you know, this sort of ironic name of, you know, I don't know, a pair of monks, you know, making cheap liquor. I just thought of it as like a presence, like the Christian Brothers character is like a kind of presence. Fake concerns is what's the matter, man. And you think I ought to shake your motherfucking
hand? You know, musically, you kind of talked about the beginning of the song and, you know, sort of overall, you know, what kind of drew you to it?
Overall, what drew me to it? That the cyclical nature of the song, the fact that it goes up and it goes up and it goes up and it goes up and it goes up before finally resolving. And it's like every four bars, you think to yourself, okay, this is going to resolve, this is going to resolve, this is going to resolve, but it just keeps going and going and going and going. yeah, like this Sisyphean kind of song vibe. That's what I absolutely love about it. You know, I tried to sample it, you know, like I, you know, pretty much anytime I liked anything in the 90s, the first thing I did was put it in Sonic ASR10 sampler and, you know, tried to like get a loop out of it. And his lyrics are like unloopable. Like you can't, like no single segment can be taken from the whole without needing what's before and what's after it. Like it's very much this kind of spool where you need the whole thread to have the thing. I know how much you care. Don't be cross, this sick I want. I've seen So when I met him, the first time I met him, we talked about, because I think he was sort of interested in talking to someone that wasn't in rock music per se. You know, I don't think I wasn't not in rock music, but I think he talked to me about having drummer problems, and He said, like, well, you know, like a drummer on a Sam Cooke record, those guys just play basic beats. Why can't you get a drummer to just play a basic beat? And I love that, you know, he said this, and he's the drums that he's playing on the version on the record are just really like simple hits on the two and the four, like fucking hand clap style. And I also heard for the first time in my life, unfortunately, the Heat Miser version of this song, which, I don't know, man, like, I don't know if he was just timid in suggesting to musicians that they play more simply, or if he just had like sort of a common problem you have in rock bands, which is everybody wants to make their part more complicated than it necessarily has to be. But It illuminated why he did that simple snare part on the recording.
And when is it that you first met him?
I think it was like 96 or something. It was in the East Village. His rep at I think it was BMG knew my A&R guy at Warner Brothers. And I don't remember why we all were out together, but I mostly talked to him about drummers. You know, I mean, I was a huge fan, but I didn't, you know, like I'm not going to like make them have some awkward interaction. So we talked about drummers and, you know, it's so funny because in... I guess in the rock world at the time, it's not like if you went to your producer and were like, I want a drummer that's going to play like a drummer on a Sam Cooke record, you know, they would, you know, open up their Rolodex and have these numbers. Producers were, you know, just accustomed to working with these fully formed bands that would come in, that they would just record, that they strictly had a sonic relationship with. And I remember reading an interview with Larry Crane where he said he was working with Elliot on something that there were strings, and Elliot kind of like felt bad about having to reject the string part, whatever it was. So I do think that was very much part of his personality to not want to get on another musician and make them change what they're doing. I think he was a little bashful about that.
You saw him play in New York also, right?
Well, it was a couple of years before that. And I just went to meet a friend of mine at Fez, which was a bar on Lafayette Street under the Time Cafe. And it was during, I think, the New Music Seminar, which was like a convention, you know, sort of like a South by Southwest in New York type of a thing. And I just went to meet my friend and had no idea who was playing. And I saw the Magnetic Fields and Elliott Smith play to like nobody, like nobody, both like kind of annoyed at the sound man. And Fez was famously in a basement kind of near the 6 train track, so you'd actually hear the subway like rumble the room during the show. And so it was like clearly like an off night for everybody, but I mean, it was astonishing, just totally astonishing. Like the next day I went out, I don't know if it's that there was a snowstorm. It was like a big snowstorm, whatever year it was, 95, 96 in New York. And I remember like trudging up Avenue A to the record store. And that was the CD that they had. I got Get Lost by the Magnetic Fields and that album by Elliott.
You met him out in Los Angeles too, also, right?
Yeah, he came out to do a part to be sampled and chopped up and manipulated on a Soul Coughing song, which we never used. I finished the remix like years and years later, but he came to Sunset Sound Factory and we sat him in front of a binaural head, which is it's a binaural microphone that's meant to mimic how the human head hears, and it actually in the shape of a mannequin head, so it is like this weird gray foam abstract head that you sit somebody in front of to sing into. And I think he was amused by that.
So you were working on a song and you had thought, oh, Elliott Smith would be a great addition to this song, and you invited him?
Yeah, well, I essentially wanted to get snippets from him that I could like manipulate and play as a almost like a mellotron or a sound effects machine. Like that sort of usage of a vocal sample.
Like what you were trying to do with Christian Brothers and recording a sample of it.
Exactly. Yes. And he didn't really understand it, which it was always heartbreaking to me, because, you know, I was so like excited by and interested in dance music and hip hop and sample based music. And, so he did like 3 songs for me, but they were essentially songs, as opposed to, you know, the kind of snippets that I was looking for, the kind of, you know, just sort of instrumental hits.
So you'd mentioned you did that recording with him, you know, back in the 90s. And hadn't done anything with it. And I read an article, I don't know, from some years ago where I guess maybe you did release it. And it didn't seem like that was very well received.
There were basically like 3 audiences that heard it on my SoundCloud page. There were Elliott fans, there were fans of mine, Soul Coughing fans, and then there were like random dance music people who were listening because I put up this mix of classic house music that was called like 38 classic house tracks in 39 minutes. It was like some like ultra mega mix of house music from like 88 to 91. And so the Soul Clapping fans responded to it negatively just as I wasn't on it. And whenever I do something that I'm not singing on, they don't like it. The diehard Elliott fans that thought they were going to find a new Elliott recording fucking hated it. Fucking hated it. Yeah. And then the people who were just random house music fans, techno fans, were like, oh, this is kind of neat. Like, I really like this. Like, this sounds really alternative. Who's this vocalist? You know, and they, of course, had no idea. They had just put in the keywords classic house, and they knew nothing about who I was or who Elliott was or who anybody was. They were just passing through. They liked it a lot. Wow, I mean, I love how I've seen the boss blink on and off, has a harmony on the last repetition of it in the coda. It's just such a cool move to like to ornament that last chorus and not repeat that ornamentation like on the second repetition, to just have that in the coda. That's the kind of move that I just love. And Christian Brothers, always, I mean, it's a perennial for me. It's like, it's one of the great songs of that, the great, not just great songs, but great recordings of that era.
So thanks to Mike and Elizabeth for that interview. And next up in 2 weeks' time, we'll be speaking with the musician Rebecca Gates. Rebecca was part of a band called The Spinanes and sang backing vocals on the album version of St. Ide's Heaven. It was lovely chatting to Rebecca and hearing her story, so hopefully you can join us for that one when it's out. And that's pretty much it for today. Thanks again for joining us, and we'll see you soon.